You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. And we are broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in sunny Fairfield on solar-powered KRUU.
And solar today is meaning, wow.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good thing. It's a good thing to be solar-powered on a sunny day.
Yes, it is.
Sunny day. So, Caroline, oh, I guess we should introduce the show. This is Writer's Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Mom.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. As we said, it's a beautiful day, hot, humid, but the sun is nice because we've had a lot of rain.
That is true, even in my inside my house.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't, yeah. Did I tell you about all that? Yeah, well, we won't go into that. Anyway, my misfortunes are pretty minor.
Compared to the misfortunes of people depicted in this book, which
yes.
Murderous intellectuals, German elites, and the Nazi SS. And it is not an easy book to read in the fact that it goes into detail, some detail, but it is an easy book to read.
Okay. Yeah, a little, having some technical difficulties here.
Okay, this book is, I'll read from the back. Jonathan Maxwell's compelling readable book takes the reader inside Nazi Germany on many different levels. The book provides a portrait of a people and a country in continuous flux, from the events that led to Hitler's popularity to the Hitler Youth Movement, to the embrace of national socialism, to Hitler's warped inner circle. A fine piece of work. This book will appeal to general readers interested in the inherent drama of Hitler's unnerving rise to power and his subsequent apocalyptic fall. The main thing is, I asked myself over and over, can this happen again? And that's the terrifying thing about it. I think it's probably possible. Do you agree?
So, Jonathan, welcome to Writer's Voices.
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry about the difficulties.
Oh, just one of those things. Got to roll with it. So Jonathan is from Georgia, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. And what, you know, so you want to answer Caroline's question? You know, could this happen again, in your opinion?
Well, you know, actually it has happened again. At the end of World War II, many people declared never again, meaning that they would never allow another genocide to happen. But, of course, it has happened again. In the mid to late 1970s in Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge regime murdered about 2 to 3 million of its own population. And virtually, you know, that the UN and the U.S. did virtually nothing to stop that. In the late 1980s, in the early 1990s, there was a genocide going on in the former Yugoslavia. Fortunately, the U.S. And the UN did intervene, although they should have intervened earlier. In the early 1990s in Rwanda, there was a genocide going on, and again, the response from, you know, the international sphere was almost non-existent. Currently, there are supposed to be two genocides going on, one in Darfur, Africa, and the other one going in Tibet. And frequently I get asked, could such a thing happen in America? My response is that it has happened in America. Look what we did to the native populations. And, you know, that was certainly a genocide. And white people's treatment of African Americans, that was not a genocide in the most literal sense. However, it was certainly a cultural genocide. You know, and these abuses range from kidnapping, deportation, enslavement, the loss of civil liberties, and, you know, the complete denial of human rights. Could it happen in America now? Personally, I'm very doubtful.
Yes.
I think the reason for that would be that Americans do have such respect for the rule of law. And another thing is that even though there seems to be a surge of what I call the balkanization of this country, meaning social groups pitted against one another, you know, rich against poor, white against black, liberal versus conservative, Republican versus Democrat. Increasingly, we don't seem to view Americans as being part of a melting pot. Increasingly, social groups seem to be pitted against one another in, you know, a desperate drive for, you know, resources. However, very few people are debating, you know, these the rights of these groups to exist. That was one crucial factor in Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. Not only was there disagreement, but, you know, many people felt like peoples who were different than they were, you know, deserved to be, you know, slaughtered just because of who they were. So certainly America has that, you know, going for. That being said, there's always a chance in any nation, you know, before, you know, the rise of Hitler, Germany was one of the most progressive civilized states on Earth. It actually had a reputation for treating its Jewish citizens very well. And, you know, the Germans did have a respect for the rule of law. But, you know, it happened there, so you can never say never.
Well, that's the thing, you know, and of course, someone like Hitler could take over the United States, but in the free exchange of ideas that we have here between Republicans and Democrats and conservatives and liberals and so forth, that's the basis of freedom, isn't it? The freedom to say what you believe.
That's true.
Well, sure. But, you know, the parallels between Nazi Germany and the U.S., they are, in fact, rather considerable, which is very disturbing. You know, during the 1920s through the early 1930s, Germany's economy was doing very poorly. War had, you know, drained the country of its finances. There was massive unemployment. People were desperate. And certainly during those times when things seemed to be, you know, hitting the fan, a lot of people, you know, gravitate towards extreme viewpoints as well as demagogues. And mm-hmm. to a considerable degree, you know, things are happening, you know, like that here in contemporary America. Many Americans, particularly those from the working classes, they're unemployed, their unemployment insurance benefits are running out, they're feeling desperate, and it's not coincidental that extremist groups are on the rise in America. Because extremist groups, you know, just like the Nazis did, they claim that they have all the answers. And people are desperate for answers. And, you know, they're also looking for scapegoats. People, you know, whom to blame. For the Germans, it was the Jews. Here in America, you know, in much less extreme forms, you know, we have scapegoats, mostly Muslims, who incidentally are generally very peaceful in America, as well as Hispanic laborers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
If you're just tuning in, this is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jonathan Maxwell, the author of Murderous Intellectuals, German Elites and the Nazi SS. Jonathan, what drew you to this subject?
Ultimately, I guess the inspiration goes to my father. Back in the late 1960s, he was drafted. Everybody was afraid that he was going to be sent to Vietnam. Instead, he was sent to Germany. And instantly, he fell in love with the German people. He thought that they were creative, self-reliant, hardworking, clean, respectable. You know, he just loved German culture, everything about it. He loved the cleanliness of the streets and, you know, the architecture. When he came back here to America on occasion, he would tell stories of his experiences in Germany to my brother and myself, and obviously we were all very impressed. But at the same time, we were beginning to learn in school that during the 1920s up until the end of World War II, many Germans were doing horrific things to innocent people. And even at such an early age, I guess I was 8 or 9 at the time, I was still able to understand the glaring contradiction. How does a people descend so quickly and easily into savagery? And that question never really left my mind. By the time I was in high school, I was, you know, reading regularly about the Holocaust, which I suppose is a bit strange. Now, I was an English major in college, so I didn't have a lot of time for reading for, you know, my own personal gratification. So I did, you know, some studying about the Holocaust, but, you know, once I graduated, I went back into it, you know, in full swing. And I read book after book, and, you know, there are great books about the Holocaust, certainly, but no book really answered that question for me, and it grew very frustrating. You know, the typical American perception of the Nazis is they were street thugs and brawlers and misfits. To a considerable degree, that was true. But at the same time, the more I read, I realized that a lot of individuals, particularly at the leadership levels, you know, didn't really fit that stereotype. In fact, the Nazi Party was actually full of social elites, individuals who held at least a bachelor's degree. They came from stable upper middle class or upper class backgrounds. Many of them had Catholic or Lutheran backgrounds, and you know, they were generally you know, very well respected. But no book really, you know, asked why, you know, that was the case. And I guess eventually I just became so frustrated that I decided to write a book about the topic myself.
I noticed that you quote quite often from The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, that book. And that, of course, was is full of history, and I'm sure that was a help to you. And I think the research for this must have been tremendous, because you have so many, for instance, that telling about the different individuals and their backgrounds and what their beliefs were and how they conducted themselves within the Third Reich, and it was really tremendous the way you did that.
You know, it wasn't as difficult as a lot of people might imagine. One of the reasons why, you know, it was not so difficult for me was the fact that I had a lot of enthusiasm for the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Studying about the Holocaust, it's certainly not entertaining or fun, but it was very gratifying. And I particularly enjoyed how much I learned about the subject myself. I never ever felt overwhelmed. Sometimes I found it, you know, very depressing. And
yeah.
Because of that, you know, I would take breaks from time to time, maybe, you know, as long as a month. But, and, you know, I routinely give out this advice to would-be writers, you know, write a book about something, you know, about a topic that really interests you, that you feel a lot of passion for.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you're just, I guess you could say, going by the numbers, phoning it in, you know, I think you're going to get nowhere with the project. If you don't have, you know, real enthusiasm for the project, it's going to be overwhelming. Yeah. Because writing a book, it's basically the mental equivalent of running a marathon.
Oh, yes.
If you don't have enthusiasm, you're going to get bogged down really, really quickly.
Now, how long did you...
You know, the Holocaust was not particularly interesting to me. Certainly the research would have been, you know, overwhelming for me. So you really have to have a lot of passion for the project. And, you know, I'm just delighted, you know, by the fact that, you know, this is the kind of book that I wanted to write about.
Jonathan,
and,
how long did you...
One of the most rewarding experiences I found as a new and an emerging writer. You know, I wrote a book that I really wanted to write.
Well, speaking of being a new and emerging writer, this book won some awards. It won the online publication Author Exposure rated this work as being one of the 20 most memorable debut books of 2010. Jonathan, how long did you actually spend on this project?
I guess the research took about a year on and off, and the actual writing took about 6 months.
And were you working full time?
I could have done it faster. Ordinarily, you should be able to complete a book in about a year, but. I did feel like it was necessary to take a break from it from time to time. I've written three books since, and they've each taken me about a year because I was dealing with subjects that weren't so depressing and arresting. You know, I didn't take these, you know, long breaks, so I was able to finish those faster. But, about a year and a half.
And were you writing essentially full-time, or did you have another job at this while you were doing this?
I was doing it full-time.
Great.
What's really sad to me is the Holocaust, people who don't believe that it happened, the Holocaust deniers. I just don't know. I can't imagine where they're coming from here.
Yes, it is very interesting. Personally, I've actually had experience with them. I knew that would be, you know, inevitable. I just didn't think it was going to be so chilling. I was sending out queries to a radio host, just like I sent out a query to, you know, your program. And it was on a Sunday, and this radio host, he hosted a show about books. And he told me, he wrote me back very promptly saying that he wouldn't have me on my show because he doesn't promote the work of Jewish propagandists. And obviously,
oh,
I was really taken aback. So I sent him another email saying, are you implying that the Holocaust never happened? And within a few minutes, he shot me, you know, back another email saying that everybody knows that the Holocaust was a fraud.
Oh, yeah, we do.
That's absolutely amazing. And, and this was a fella who was very much supposed to be an intellectual. I mean, he hosted a radio show about books. I just, you know, found it to be unbelievable.
Well, considering the records that the Germans kept of their atrocities and the numbers of people, I mean, this is what is amazing to me, because they did keep very precise records, didn't they, the Germans?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And they were oftentimes very, very proud of their work.
Right.
And, you know, and they did a lot of this documentation, you know, for posterity, because they believed that the Holocaust was going to be an ongoing thing, and the next generation coming up, you know, were to, you know, learn the tactics of the previous generation. You know, it's probably the most documented historical pattern in history next to World War II as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And during my experience, I came to believe that a lot of these individuals, you know, oftentimes, you know, they weren't necessarily anti-Semitic. With a lot of these people, they had Gentile German ancestry, and a lot of them just did not want to accept the fact that, you know, their ancestors could have theoretically committed, you know, all these atrocities. And, you know, this is growing since so many people, you know, who experienced the Holocaust firsthand, a lot of these individuals are disappearing. And Holocaust revisionism, it's really on the rise, and I find it very telling that when you examine these Holocaust websites, it can be very, very surprising. One is that oftentimes these websites, they're very professionally edited, they're very professionally designed. You know, some intelligent people are behind this. And another thing that I find very surprising is that people will leave comments about the content on the website. And a lot of these individuals are kids, you know, teenagers, sometimes even young adults. And, you know, they're giving thank you to these people saying that, you know, thanks for giving me the truth. You know, I knew that my ancestors in Germany could not have committed such things. So a lot of it has to do with simple denial. And you actually find the same thing down here in the American Southeast. I tell you, there are still Southerners to this day who will never admit that slavery was the underlying cause of the Civil War. they'll say something about states' rights. They'll say something about trade embargoes. They will never admit that, you know, their ancestors could have been slaveholders or supporters of the system. They don't want to believe that their ancestors could have engaged in such practices. And here again, you find the same, you know, lack of logic. The Civil War has been, you know, thoroughly, relentlessly documented. And very early on, it seems obvious that slavery was the underlying cause. Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, openly admitted that it was on more than one occasion. So, yes, a lot of it is anti-Semitism, but then again, there are other forces at work. Some are simple individuals who don't believe that their ancestors could have done such things. But, you know, if you take a look at the facts, sure, there are good reasons to believe that they did, you know, commit such atrocities.
Now, Caroline, you have a...
It was very accepted in German society, surprisingly enough, just as slavery was commonly accepted, you know, all through the antebellum days of the American Southeast.
Well, from what I understand, Germany has an official position. They've been very good about teaching the facts about the Holocaust in their schools, whereas some other countries ignore parts of their history that they're not proud of.
Right.
So that's at least one good thing. And Caroline, tell about the
okay. In one of our local papers, the Burlington Hawkeye, to be exact, this headlines: "Grandchildren of Nazis delve into the past." And this woman, who was the her great grandfather would have been Rudolf Hess, Hoess, and he was in charge of Auschwitz from May 1940 to November 1943, and she has written a book about that, about his involvement and telling what it did to her family. And she said, "My grandfather was a mass murderer, something that I can only be ashamed and sad about." She said that some grandchildren of Nazis find a measure of catharsis in confronting the past, and that's what it's done for her, because said the guilt and shame of that, of his doing, was overwhelming, and she had to write this for her children so that they could face that.
Yeah.
You know,
Jonathan, did you speak to any of the descendants of the people you wrote about in Murderous Intellectuals?
Oh, sure, or you know, a few, but you know, sadly, you know, it's hard to find such individuals anymore. You know, they're dying off very, very quickly, along with World War II veteran, soldiers. I mean, they're very quickly dying off. That being said, I did meet a few, and their stories were just absolutely astonishing. I was at a literary festival in Galanica, Georgia, and there was a woman whom I met, and I noticed that she had a Romanian or Slavic accent, and I asked, where she was from, and indeed she was Romanian, and we talked a little bit further, and this woman, who was, probably in her 70s, she told me that during childhood, she was interned in Nazi labor camps. I just find it absolutely amazing that she was able to survive.
Well, you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jonathan Maxwell, the author of Murderous Intellectuals, German Elites and the Nazi SS.
Now, I'm wondering, did you have any trouble finding a publisher for this?
I was very, very lucky. I sent it out to one publisher, and 3 weeks later, I was issued a contract. That being said,
wow.
My other books, sure, I received a lot of rejections, and I also received a lot of rejections from agents. And that, unfortunately, is just an unavoidable aspect of the publishing industry. I mean, you have to go through a lot of yeses. You have to go through a lot of
no's.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, it can be very draining, and it can be very, very... it can be devastating, particularly if you're very shy and sensitive, which a lot of writers are. But my advice to would-be writers is just accept that fact. It's unavoidable, but it's all about persistence. If you don't give up, if you continue writing, I will guarantee you that you will get published. Publish, reputably. It just takes persistence. Now, I'm not going to tell you that your first book is going to sell, 100,000 copies. That's extremely rare. However, I will guarantee you that, if you work at it, if you're persistent, you will get published, whether that's in a magazine, or it's a publishing company wanting to publish your book, or whatever. In the end, it's many things, but I think above all, it's all about persistence, that and learning from your mistakes.
Now, Jonathan, your publisher is American Book Publishing, and you said that was the first one you sent your book to. Why did you choose this particular publisher?
In all honesty, I was attracted to the fact that they tend to specialize in supporting, new and emerging authors. A lot of the major old New York publishing houses, like Random House, it's very difficult if you're a first-time writer to get, the publishing contract from, someone like, that. So that I found, very, very appealing. And American Book Publishing, they really nurture their artists, and they also taught me all about promotion. And that was just absolutely invaluable, because in all honesty, I knew absolutely nothing about book marketing. I didn't know a thing about it. I knew what a gerund was. I know how to write fairly well, but I knew virtually nothing about book marketing. But they taught me all about that. It's been extremely useful.
Well, that's something you have to know. You know, a lot of people ask, how in the world could this happen? How could the ordinary German person let this happen in their country? But early on, the Nazi Party took charge of everything, all the media, the schools, which I found interesting. One thing here you said, Hitler and his colleagues tried to redo math and science to fit their ideology, and meant that those disciplines suffered in the expansion and development in that country. And I'm sure, I mean, they tried to put everything into their master race theory, and that must have been interesting.
Oh, sure. And the thing that I was really shocked by was the fact that it was supposedly intellectuals who were putting forth these, you know, ridiculous ideas. And, you know, before the rise of Hitler, a lot of these individuals actually had, you know, very, very respectable backgrounds. There were two Nazi scientists who actually won Nobel Prizes.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't bystanders either. You know, these were men who were very supportive of Hitler. They actually removed more liberal academics from German universities. They also sent many of these individuals to the concentration camps, where many of them died. And, you know, Johann Stark and Philipp Lenard, the individuals in question, they weren't particularly exceptional. There was a death squad commander out in the former Yugoslavia, Oskar Jellwanger, who openly encouraged his men to commit atrocities like mass murder and rape. Indeed, he often took part in such activities. Now, this man sounds like a total barbarian, but he was also superbly educated. He held a doctorate in political science. There was a death squad commander out in the Ukraine, Otto Ollendorf. Over a period of 6 months, he and his men shot down about 100,000 Jews. Obviously, we're talking about a dangerous fanatical criminal, but again, he was superbly educated. He held doctorates both in law and in economics. And, you know, their qualifications, it reveals a lot about their mindset. Hitler needed intellectuals. He needed bureaucrats. He needed doctors. He needed engineers and architects to, you know, build the Nazi state. Even though he needed intellectuals, the intellectuals never really needed him. Someone like Otto Ollendorf, who held, you know, doctorates in law and economics, if he had never heard of Adolf Hitler, he would have done just fine. You know, he would have remained a respected lawyer and economist.
Mm-hmm.
So it tells you that these men, despite their qualifications, their credentials, their educations, you know, they could be just as brutal and as disturbed as the lowliest of street brawlers. You know, these men, you know, they supported Hitler. They liked his ideas. They thought along the same lines as Hitler did.
That seems hard to believe, doesn't it, really? It seems hard to believe.
Now, in your book, Jonathan, you identify 11 reasons why these intellectuals would have joined the Nazi Party and cooperated with Hitler. And do you want to go through those reasons? Because a large section of the book sort of addresses each of these reasons individually.
Okay. Yeah. Let me open up my book here. Give me a moment, please.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting the way the book is structured. The beginning, the first part of the book, we have a brief history of the Holocaust, and then there's chapters on the various types of intellectuals that became part of the Third Reich. We have the desk murderers,
the doctors, the scientists, the engineers, architects, lawyers. Yes, Nazi soldiers.
Right.
Sure.
Right. And then we turn to the motivations.
Motivations that I found to be convincing. One is the fact that, you know, there was no single reason that explained these individuals. There were several reasons, and they tended to work in tandem with one another. One was personal reasons. That could mean a number of things. It could be, you know, a well-paying job, job security, safety, a sense of belonging. Sadism was another factor. Racism and ethnic hatred, the autocratic nature of German society, mental illness, Freudian theory, charismatic authority, nationalism, human genetics, excessive reverence for the opinions of social elites, and finally, evil. And evil, I think, is ultimately the most satisfying one. Because you know, that's what they were. You know, these men and women, they knew what they were doing. These were educated men and women. I think some of it was hatred for so-called undesirables, but a lot of it was simply greed and a thirst for power. These individuals, they weren't robots and they weren't sheep, and they actually had very, very diverse backgrounds. Some of them were superbly educated and came from upper class households, but others were individuals like Franz Stangl, the commandant of Treblinka. He actually had a very modest, modest origins, but because of his organizational skill, because of his drive, he was able to reach the top of the Nazi hierarchy. So these were all very diverse individuals, actually, but they all had one thing in common. They wanted wealth and they wanted power. And they knew that during that time period, the best avenue for getting those things was to join the Nazi SS, because if you joined the Nazi SS and you worked hard and you obeyed orders, you could develop an astonishing amount of wealth and power in only, you know, 2 or 3 years. So greed and thirst for power was, you know, those were major, major causes. You know, these individuals, they were of sound mind. I actually once spoke with a reporter for the Atlanta Jewish Times. He was able to put it far more succinctly than I ever could. He said that these Nazi elites, they bet on the wrong horse, essentially. They thought that Adolf Hitler was going to be their meal ticket. And for several years, you know, he was. But then Germany lost the war, and, you know, they became criminals instead.
Yes, and this idea of master race. I mean, you pointed out how after the war they were so humiliated and couldn't understand how this could happen. I mean, we are the master race, and we lost the war again.
Yeah. Well, I think that over the long scope of history, and certainly this doesn't always reflect in current events, but over the long scope of history, any nation or culture that oppresses, represses, suppresses, and a segment of their population, whether it be for ethnic reasons, religious reasons, or gender identity, will not succeed in the long term, because society succeeds by maximizing the potential of all of its members.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, you would also need to include, you know, multiculturalism, tolerance for opposing viewpoints, mm-hmm. and, you know, different ethnicities. And, yes, you touched on something, you know, really astute there. You know, totalitarian societies, Nazi Germany was one, Cambodia during the 1970s, Stalinist Russia, Mao Zedong's China. You know, these totalitarian states, generally they're disastrous. And these governments, they wind up, you know, horribly abusing their own citizens. Yeah, certainly, absolutely. Democratic states, for all their faults and their perceived weaknesses, they're the most promising of, government institutions.
Right.
In many ways, democracy is indispensable. And it was a very short-sighted on the Nazis' part that they couldn't realize this. Virtually all of the successful nations in the world, whether that's the United States, Japan, Canada, the nations of Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, all of these states are democratic ones. So that alone tells you that democratic governments are always the best.
And, Albert Einstein was a German Jew.
Yes, he was.
And look at all the Germans missed out by...
Oh, yeah.
By,
right.
By not valuing him.
Yeah. Well, Gandhi...
Absolutely. The German generals, they were actually pushing for an atomic bomb program.
Yes.
Because they realized that when the U.S. entered the war, there was almost no hope for any sort of decisive victory on Germany's part. It would be a stalemate that would last for decades. So they were really pushing for an atomic bomb program. But the true rabidly anti-Semitic Nazis, such as Hitler and Joseph Goebbels, they actually believed the Aryan science nonsense. And they believed that since Albert Einstein was a Jew, that his theories regarding nuclear fission and fusion had to be worthless. So Hitler immediately put a stop to the atomic bomb program, and that single action that basically doomed the any hopes for a German victory. To a considerable degree, Hitler was responsible for the loss of Nazi Germany, ironically enough.
Interesting, wasn't it? Interesting. Well, I'm always reminded of what Mahatma Gandhi once said, that all through history there have been despots and tyrants, but they always fall, always.
Oh, sure, absolutely, yeah. Whether that's Jim Jones or Perón, Fidel Castro, he's been surprisingly resilient, but overwhelmingly Cuba seems to be moving away from communism. But in the long run, despots accomplish little, and oftentimes they're the victims of coup d'etat once the citizens begin to realize that although these demagogues promise everything, usually they deliver nothing. That's certainly a good point, absolutely. But I have to say one more thing about that. Even today, many people still fall for demagogues, particularly now when America is filled with deficits, there's massive unemployment, our financial resources have been drained by two wars, and, demagogues are, certainly at the forefront right now, like Donald Trump and Sarah Palin, along with even more, odious figures, like, neo-Nazis. People are always going to have a weakness for such individuals, particularly if these demagogues tell them exactly what they want to hear. Hitler told the German people exactly what they wanted to hear. You know, the Germans were the master race. They had a mission from God. They were destined for greatness. You know, people are going to respond positively towards that, particularly if before they felt, you know, powerless and humiliated. And, you know, you see that trend right now. You know, a lot of people feel humiliated. A lot of people have lost their jobs. You know, they're looking for answers. And when these things happen, demagogues almost inevitably come into play, which is one of the reasons why these neo-Nazi groups are undergoing a resurgence right now.
Well, in the 50s, I had a professor at the University of Iowa who was Dr. Mossy, who was the head of World History Department. And one of his lectures, he said that he was in Germany during the rise of Hitler. And he said, of course, he was Jewish. He said, I was in a crowd, and they're screaming, kill the Jews. And he said, I'm screaming, kill the Jews, not because I'm afraid that they're going to kill me, but because Hitler was so powerful. He was such a powerful speaker that he just moved people to these feelings.
Yeah, in many ways, he was the ultimate demagogue. And it's funny that you should mention that. A lot of Jewish children, they actually wanted to be a part of the Hitler Youth simply because that organization seemed to give its members such a sense of belonging. You know, that's... yeah, it's very illuminating, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Jonathan, would you read... in the little bit of time we have left, we'd love for you to read from Murderous Intellectuals.
Yes, I'd like to read about the Nazi scientist Werner von Braun, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
It's a short passage. And here we go. At the time, German engineers were at the vanguard of rocket science. They began experimenting with rockets during World War I. The greatest German rocket pioneer was Werner von Braun. He was a wunderkind. By the time that he was 18, he was already a member of the influential Rocketport research team. A blue blood, he was born in Wurzitz, Germany in 1912. His prominent father once served as the Minister of Agriculture. At 20, he graduated from the Charlottenburg Institute of Technology. Shortly afterwards, the Army recruited him into its secret rocket research program. At the same time, he began to pursue a doctorate in applied physics at Berlin University. Hitler assumed power as von Braun's star was rising, but the researcher claimed to take little notice of him. He insisted that he cared little for politics. Von Braun played a major role in the development of the A-2 rocket, which was first launched in December 1934. The A-1 missile had been a failure. In sharp contrast, the A-2 was a tremendous success, propelling the young man into a sort of celebrity. The missile's design was revolutionary, and it provided the blueprint for future guided missiles. It used separate fuel and liquid oxygen tanks, which would prevent explosions caused by leaking. A gyroscope placed between the tanks, near the rocket's center of gravity, helped the rocket to maintain control during the first stages of flight. Later on, von Braun admitted that from the beginning, he knew that the military wished to utilize his designs for creating weapons of mass destruction. He seemed to feel that the Brazzers' plans did not concern him. Like von Stangl, von Braun was accused of compartmentalizing his thinking to suppress guilt. Under Hitler, who authorized massive rearmament, von Braun greatly prospered. The dictator increased the engineer's funding and allowed his research to expand. In 1935, the Luftwaffe created an alliance with von Braun's research team. This partnership fellowship produced even more funding for the young scientist. His research program was eventually one of the largest in world history. Von Braun was later instrumental in the creation of the landmark V2 rockets. Wernher von Braun proved his mechanical genius at an early age. However, his technological innovations came with a heavy price: slave labor. By August 1943, he was ready to begin mass producing his upgraded rockets, the A-4 missiles. The SS would share in the management of A-4 production. An underground factory was built, Mittelwerk, or Central Works. Central Works was near the city of Nordhausen in the Harz Mountains. It already had tunnels that had been used for storing oil and chemical weapons. They were large enough for two sets of parallel rail tracks to be installed. There, the rockets could safely be built in secret. Heinrich Himmler, the top man within the Nazi SS, would soon dispatch concentration camp prisoners to this new work site. Within 6 weeks, 4,000 male prisoners were drafted into the Mittelwerk tunnels. By November, the number rose to 8,000. The commandant of this new work site would be SS Brigadefuhrer Hans Kammler, who was known for his ruthlessness. Kammler cared little about these forced laborers and ordered his staff to pay no attention to the human cost. The work must go ahead and in the shortest possible time. Mittelwerk made for a hellish work environment. Eventually, the forced laborers had barracks. Collectively, they constituted the camp known as Dora. This housing project was erected outside the tunnels. However, the barracks provided little comfort to the workers in the long run. As at all of the Nazi camps and work sites, Kapos and SS men frequently beat the forced laborers during the typical 15-hour days. By the end of each shift, many exhausted workers could not even walk back to the barracks. Thus, they slept on rocks. Hygiene and washing facilities were practically non-existent. Dysentery was rampant at Mittelwerk, and many deportees fouled their trousers regularly. Within 7 months, 6,000 of the original slaves were dead.
Wow.
The noises of the machines and the dynamite explosions damaged the eardrums of some workers. Large amounts of dust in the air induced serious respiratory ailments in other deportees. Ultimately, Himmler, Kammler, and the Nazi bureaucrat Albert Speer bore responsibility for the grotesque excesses committed at Mittelwerk and Dora. However, there is evidence that von Braun approved of the slave labor. It is certain that he knew about the deportees. As a power player within the Third Reich, how could he not have known about them? It is also certain that he profited immensely from their exploitation. If von Braun had misgivings about this merciless exploitation, he never uttered them publicly or through official channels. In February 1944, von Braun had an unfortunate brush with Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler. Although this brush caused the scientist much grief at the time, it later became a sort of blessing for him. Heinrich Himmler had asked the scientist to abandon the army to begin working directly for the SS instead. The wily SS leader secretly wanted to take over the A4 project. Von Braun politely declined the offer from the Reichsfuhrer and gave no further thought to the matter. Then in March, the Gestapo arrested him, charging the scientist with defeatism, an alleged association with communists. 2 weeks later, Albert Speer, a bitter rival of Himmler's, helped win von Braun's freedom.
Okay, Jonathan, I'm going to have to cut you off there because we're about out of time. But then, so von Braun, because he was arrested by the SS, that helped him get off from punishment from...
Yeah, absolutely.
At Nuremberg,
The U.S. military and NASA suppressed all the available evidence, which showed that he used slave labor.
Yeah.
Listeners can find my book on Amazon.com, as well as at Barnes & Noble and at Borders.
And, of course, you can order it from your local independent bookstore as well.
And it's Murderous Intellectuals.
And if you want to, if you missed part of this interview, it will be up on the KRUUFM.com archives and also at writersvoices.com. So it'd be, you're welcome to check it out there.
I have a
I want to apologize for the technical difficulties. Things were a little uncertain there for a while.
We got but we got off to a rough start, but it worked out okay in the end. So thank you so much to Jonathan Maxwell for being with us here on Writers' Voices. His book again is Murderous Intellectuals, German Elites and the Nazi SS.
And can I say this last thing?
Yeah.
Okay, asking how can this happen? Bernard Shaw once said, "The moment we want to believe something, we suddenly see all the arguments for it and become blind to the arguments against it."
Wow. And good luck with your next books. Let us know when they come out, Jonathan.
Oh, absolutely. And again, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
We'll see you next week on Writers' Voices.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.